RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Nico Perino is the Executive Vice President of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, FIRE, and host of its podcast, So to Speak. He's worked on films addressing free speech and censorship, contributed writings to major publications, and regularly speaks about issues of civil liberties in the United States. FIRE's mission is to defend and sustain the individual rights of all Americans to free speech and free thought, the most essential qualities of liberty. FIRE educates Americans about the importance of these inalienable rights, promotes a culture of respect for these rights, and provides the means to preserve them. And Nico Perino joins us all the way from Washington, D.C. Nico, thanks for coming on our radio station. It's great to have you.
It's great to be here, Paul. I think this is the first time I'm on New Zealand radio, so it's a pleasure.
Hopefully no one tries to censor this, because you never know these days.
You never know.
The reception will start to go funny, or there'll be something will go down. Anyway, look, I mean, so much to talk about here, but I want to start because you produced a documentary or were involved in a documentary which included this. And this is probably where free speech gets very challenging for people. And that is the notorious Skokie, Illinois case that argued for Nazis to be able to parade and speak in a Jewish neighborhood. Now, that's as confronting as freedom of speech, freedom of expression gets, right? Do you want to just take us back to that and then we can sort of talk on from there?
Well, even here in the United States, familiarity with the Skokie case isn't what it once was. So this, in free speech circles, has become the paradigmatic example of what it means to defend free speech in the most difficult circumstances. What you had was a situation in Chicago, Illinois, Midwest here in the United States, where a group of neo-Nazis wanted to rally in downtown Chicago to protest the integration between different races in that town. It's previously a very segregated part of town in southern Chicago. And they were denied by the city of Chicago the right to get a permit to rally in what they wanted to, the place they wanted to rally in, Marquette Park. So they wrote 12 letters to the surrounding suburbs asking for a permit to rally. Most of the suburbs ignored them, but Skokie, Illinois reacted like a bull to a red flag. And here's why. It had a high percentage of its population was Jewish. And not only that, 6,000 Holocaust survivors lived in Skokie, Illinois.
Right.
And many of them remembered what happened last time Nazis with swastikas on their arms came to their town. It didn't end well.
Because we weren't just talking about Nazis in thinking. They were wearing the uniforms as well, like it was so in your face.
Yeah, right? They tried to emulate the actual Nazis in Germany, and they wore the fascist uniforms with the red and armband that had the swastika on it, and they would rally throughout Chicago, and it was a small group. It was 12 to 15 crazies, but they had spent most of their time in Chicago. Here now, they were trying to go to Skokie that had a large Jewish population, including many Holocaust survivors, and I don't even know that they knew that there was Jewish citizens there and that they had many Holocaust survivors. But Skokie passed ordinances to try and prevent the neo-Nazis from rallying in their town, and the ACLU ended up coming to the neo-Nazis' defense. Not because the ACLU had any affinity for Nazis, but rather because free speech is what civil libertarians refer to as a neutral principle. It applies regardless of what your beliefs or viewpoints are. And some of the ordinances that Skokie was trying to pass in order to bar the Nazis were the same sort of ordinances that were passed in the southern part of America to deny civil rights activists the right to rally and protest. And if they could win a victory for the neo-Nazis in Skokie, they could also, through judicial precedent, win victories for civil rights demonstrators in the South. And the interesting thing about this case, Paul, is that the leaders of the ACLU that agreed to take the case were largely Jewish themselves. The lead attorney, David Goldberger, was Jewish. The executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, which had the most Jewish ACLU members, was Jewish, Ira Glasser. And then the leader of the national ACLU organization, Aryeh Nayer, was not only Jewish, but himself a Holocaust survivor, and most of his extended family was killed in the Holocaust. And so this group of Jewish lawyers came to the defense of neo-Nazis who wanted to rally in a town of Holocaust survivors. And it almost bankrupted the organization. And we can talk about that if you want. But over time, the stand on principle, once passions and factions had waned, became something that was revered here in America. This is what it means to stand for free speech. This was what it means to take part in that often attributed to Voltaire quote. I might disagree with what you have to say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say. It wasn't actually Voltaire who said it. It was his biographer, but a minor footnote to the quote. But that's what it meant, right? Jewish attorneys defending the rights of neo-Nazis to express themselves.
That was then. This is now. That seems to have been kind of forgotten, Nico.
It has.
That line in the sand.
It has. And some of your listeners might be familiar with the headlines that were grabbed in 2017 when white supremacists, white nationalists, whatever you wanted to call them, wanted to rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, on America's East Coast, to oppose the taking down of a Confederate monument, Robert E. Lee statue. It devolved into a melee, essentially. No police were seen anywhere. But the city of Charlottesville, like the city of Skokie, tried to ban the white nationalists from rallying. But the ACLU, like in Skokie, came to their defense and the rally was allowed to go forward. But unlike in Skokie, it devolved into violence and there was even a death. And you'll ask old school civil libertarians about this and they'll say, it's not free speech's fault that this devolved into a melee, that someone died. It's the fault of the police that did not keep the protesters and counter-protesters separated. And I've spent a lot of time in making my documentary, Mighty Ira, looking over archival footage from Skokie and the protests in downtown Chicago. There were police everywhere. They separated the protesters and counter-protesters, allowed them both to speak, but didn't allow it to evolve into violence. And that's what happened in Charlottesville. And as a result, free speech got blamed for this policing problem, in effect. And unlike in the Skokie case, the ACLU's own staff members revolted against the organization. You had a couple hundred ACLU attorneys and staffers say that the ACLU's rigid commitment to the First Amendment is compromising their ability to advocate for other causes that it believes in, such as racial justice. And the ACLU even reformed its legal guidelines for selecting cases to suggest essentially that they wouldn't have taken the Charlottesville case and maybe not even taken the Skokie case back in 1977. And so you have old school ACLU members now saying if the Skokie case came up today, they're not confident that the ACLU would take it.
We've had the impression from afar that the First Amendment is like chiseled in Mount Rushmore or some sort of granite slab, never to be changed. Yet here was John Kerry lamenting the First Amendment and basically saying it sort of gets in the way. And it's incredible to think that people are thinking like that now. What do you make of this sort of shift to now that is in the crosshairs, the First Amendment itself?
Yeah, well, it's always easy to look at American history and our current reverence for the First Amendment through rose-colored glasses. But the reality is for the first 140 years of American history, the First Amendment meant very little. Anti-war activists were routinely jailed. Pro-labor activists were routinely jailed. And it wasn't until 1931 that the Supreme Court of the United States, 140 years after America's founding, first struck down a speech restriction on First Amendment grounds. And then you fast forward today where you have justices of the Supreme Court saying things like the First Amendment has become so powerful in America that it's become weaponized to go after things that have no relation to speech in their mind, things like economic regulations. If you ask Americans today what the most important right that they have is, they will mostly say freedom of speech, even above the right to vote. And I was reading an article recently about the situation in the UK with the people posting memes and the incitement and the prosecutions for people speaking online. And there was a political commentator who said, people overseas don't really understand Americans' reverence for freedom of speech. It's almost like this religious-like commitment that we don't have over here. But it's a religious-like commitment that was developed over the past 100 years, frankly. And there was a concerted effort to do that. So I don't think it's a thing that can't be developed in other countries as well.
Do you think people have forgotten the meaning of the word inalienable?
Yeah, it's actually pretty interesting. When the founders were conceiving of what the First Amendment would say, you know, it says, to abbreviate, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. There was this discussion in some state constitutions, such as in Virginia's Declaration of Rights, that it should be the toleration of speech or the toleration of religious liberty. But James Madison, who was one of America's foremost founders, a president, and the lead drafter of the Bill of Rights, said, no, toleration isn't enough. It's not enough for the government to tolerate speech. This is an inalienable right that people have. They have the freedom to do something. And so whether people have forgotten what inalienable means, I don't know. You hear people talk about whether free speech is being abused, but I don't like that word either, because there's no abuse of a right within the contours of your right, if that makes sense. Like, you can't abuse an inalienable right that you have. But people are always looking for some sort of carve out to the freedom of speech. And freedom of speech, but we call them buttheads here at FIRE, right? It's like there's always, I believe in free speech, and then there's the caveat or the exception to free speech.
Yeah, but.
But today it's misinformation, disinformation. That's what John Kerry was talking about. He's like, it's hard to build consensus because everyone has different truths. Or just a couple of years ago, it was hate speech. It still is to a certain extent. Hate is in the eye of the beholder. One man's vulgarity, as the Supreme Court said, is another man's lyric. Prior to that, it was indecency. It was senators' wives going after rock music, heavy metal music, rappers. Before that, it was national security concerns. So the justifications for censorship change year to year, but the commitment to free speech needs to be maintained regardless of what the justifications are. And I think if you allow a little bit of erosion to happen, it's easier to pick away at it in bigger bites.
The Charlotte events are interesting because the lack of policing that you made a point of, and I wonder if that was a willful lack of policing or just incompetence. I don't know, you might have a view on that. But also, the way that was framed forever and a day after that, you know, President Trump saying that there are good people on both sides, and that quote being clipped right there in all the mainstream media, where he went on to, you know, explain that. And it was a completely different meaning. So, you know, mis and disinformation is a kind of a two-way street, right? And that's exercised under freedom of speech of the media, I suppose, but was essentially a lie, a big lie.
Yeah, well, you know, lies are going to happen, right? And it's the question of what you do when lies happen. It's, you can either retreat and argue that those who are partaking in the lies should be censored, or you can just fight it with whatever megaphone you have available to yourself. Lies have been with us throughout human history. And I'm worried that the solution many people are retreating to in response to it is to set up a sort of government ministry of truth like they had in George Orwell's 1984, where Winston Smith is sitting behind a desk trying to pick out the narratives that the government thinks are correct. There's not an angel in this world with whom I would entrust the authority to determine for me what information I can see. Not a authority in the world who I would have choose what books I can read, music I can listen to, or speeches I can hear. But there are some people who have this elitist opinion that people don't know what's good for them, so therefore we need to jump in on their behalf. It's very paternalistic. It's very elitist. But the sense is there. It's never them. It's never they who are affected by the misinformation or the lies or the fake news, whatever the term of the day is to describe it. It's always the other guy who needs the help, who is too dumb to think for themselves. Mm-hmm. So I do worry about that.
We're moving into interesting times because of AI. Mm-hmm. And just thinking further what you're just saying there. we're starting to see these deep fakes and some very clever use of AI to have certain people saying certain things, which are obviously satirical, I think, at this point anyway. But when the line blurs to the point where many people won't know if something's real or not, or won't even think about that, but will just take it on face value, then we're into murky waters, aren't we? They're sort of dangerous waters where discerning what is real and what comes under freedom of speech, does that accommodate deceptive speech or fake speech, especially when it can be done so convincingly well? What do you make of that?
Well, I try and just look at it from a historical perspective. Before society was very literate, people were easily fooled by things that was written down. Like if something was written down, they just assumed this was a very learned person who put it down. They believed everything that was read from the page. When movies were first invented, you have the stories about the early moviegoers who would jump out of their seats as the train was barreling toward them on the screen. The first movie was actually a movie of a train coming down the train tracks toward the audience.
Yeah.
You can find it on YouTube. Orson Welles, for example, gave a famous broadcast in 1938 on the War of the Worlds, which told the story of an alien invasion in New York, and it caused a panic in New York City. You had yellow journalism. In the early days of the internet, I would receive emails from Nigerian princes promising me millions of dollars if I could only get them out of jail or whatever it was with a cash transfer of a couple thousand dollars, right? You go through these anarchic periods anytime there's the development of new technology, where we're trying to develop the media literacy to discern truth from falsehood. And the instinct is always to censor, right? But what is the risk? What is the risk of doing that? The risk is getting ahead of the media literacy and potentially cutting off a really strong tool potentially for communication. The printing press was invented by Johannes Gutenberg. It resulted in the Reformation, which upset the truth that the Catholic Church would proffer across Europe. It resulted in the 30 Years' War, which then resulted in 8 million dead in Europe. Still the most tragic war, I think, in European history on a per capita basis. But are we worse off today for having the printing press, despite all that admitted tragedy that it contributed to?
Yep.
So I am worried. When the internet was first founded, people wanted to censor that. We had the Communication Decency Act here in the United States. It was struck down on First Amendment grounds, thankfully. But if Congress had gotten its way out of fear of the internet, I don't know that the internet and all the benefits and economic growth that has stemmed from it would have happened. So, and that's the First Amendment that saved it. Now, you might think the internet is bad and it's now proffered all this misinformation. Maybe so, we can have that debate. But the larger point is that we should be careful to rush towards censorship after the advent of any new technologies, including artificial intelligence. Now, artificial intelligence might be different, right? But everyone always thinks the new technology is different. Everyone thinks this is the exception. Everyone thinks this is now the time to censor.
I'm thinking of October 7th, because one thing we've noticed here at our radio station, we have people of differing views on that event, but also what has come from that event. And, of course, then the whole history of that part of the world, Israel, Palestine, Middle East, comes up. And it's very polarizing. Okay. And it's interesting because both sides of that will tell us or comment that we shouldn't have that other person on to talk about this, like a limiting of speech, ultimately. But it's both sides. There's no virtue on any side when it comes to that issue. What is it about that issue, do you think, that does polarize probably people who think they are for free speech and have them writing into us saying, you can't have that person on, you know, you shouldn't have that person on, have this person on, and then we'll have that person on, and other people come and say, well, you shouldn't have that person on. And, you know, it sort of spins the head a bit.
It's a great question, Paul. And we've noticed throughout our 25-year history here at FIRE that when we're doing free speech work, primarily on college campuses, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict raises tensions more than anything else. Why? I don't know. I think it's because it's an ancient conflict that gets at kind of the origins of humanity. It has ties with ethnicity and religion. I sent an email to our staff a day or two after October 7th, and I said, let's batten down the hatches because things are about to get hot. And unfortunately, I was right. And I said, "We not only are they going to get hot, we're going to have to be careful in how we talk about it, right? Because people are on hair triggers to try and identify anything that you say that might be wrong or that might suggest that you're partisan in one way or another. We're a free speech organization. We call balls and strikes. If the speech is protected, we defend it. No throat clearing, no apologies. So unlike other free speech organizations, we at FIRE don't editorialize on the speech we're defending. We won't say that, oh, this speech was hateful and bigoted, but, as we were talking about earlier. We'll just say it's protected, and this is the reason why you need to have this protection, so on and so forth. So, for example, I told our staff, when we're talking about this conflict, let's call it the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because here in the United States, Palestine isn't a recognized state, right? And so if we use the word Palestine, people might suggest that we think there should be a state of Palestine, and that's not our issue. You know, you probably have differing opinions here within FIRE about whether you should have a Palestinian state or not. But since then, the campuses here in the United States have erupted, and you have encampments on campus where people are spending the night. You have situations where students are having their access to different portions of campus blocked. You're having protests. You're having building occupations. And one of the things that we're called on to do is to either support it all or condemn it all. But you can't do that because every situation on every campus is different. In some cases, you have people just peacefully protesting, right, as they should be able to. In other cases, you have them engaged in unprotected conduct, such as building occupations, that is a demonstration of civil disobedience, and they have to accept the consequences for that. But because passions are so high, it's hard to have that nuanced approach to the facts on the ground at any individual school. People just want to know what side you're on, and that's a tough place to be when you're a civil libertarian and you just need to call balls and strikes.
Comedy. I want to get onto comedy because usually that is the safety valve for society for dealing with difficult issues, let's say. Mm-hmm. And I think you've been involved in the movie Can We Take a Joke? Comedians are canaries in the coal mine, really, aren't they?
Yes. They are. And this documentary project that we worked on, film came out, Can We Take a Joke, in 2015, really used the life and times of Lenny Bruce, great stand-up comedian, grandfather or godfather of stand-up comedy in large respects, as a through line to tell a story about what comedy means in society and to comment on some of the concerning trends we had seen in comedy and censorship in recent years. Lenny Bruce was a guy who was constantly, he had edgy comedy, wouldn't be edgy by our standards today, but of his times, the 1960s and 50s definitely were. And he was constantly harassed by police in New York City and San Francisco. He was put on trial and ultimately he died. Many people think he was driven to death by all the trials that he was put through here in the United States. And you'd get weird scenarios during some of these trials where you had the prosecution or the judges reading his jokes in front of the jury. And he was like, no, don't, you're doing it all wrong. Comedy is so much about it is inflection and delivery. And he said, people aren't going to understand the jokes if you're just reading them rotely in front of a jury. He's like, let me do my bit, so people can understand that I have a point behind these jokes, right?
Yeah.
And of course, when you have an adversarial prosecutor reading it, for example, they're not going to be as charitable to your jokes as you might be. So we use that as a through line to talk about what it means for a broader society when you go after comedians. Because comedians are always pushing boundaries. They're always walking that fine line, right? And sometimes they're going to step over it as they're trying to hone their craft. And in the period between 2015 and I think largely 2022, where the cancel culture started to break, the fever started to break, comedians were saying things like they don't want to play college campuses because they have audiences full of hall monitors. Or you had people being kicked off Saturday Night Live, the big comedy program here in the United States, because they told a raunchy joke at some point. And if you're having to kind of like navigate and walk through a minefield to tell a joke, that's not an environment that any comedian wants to operate in. And so, fortunately, I think this fever has broken, at least here in the United States, a little bit. People have gotten fed up with this politically correct comedy. But it's a recurring theme throughout American history. America is a boomerang. Right. So we might be in a calm period now, but I suspect it'll come back at some point once the moral panic surrounding it pick back up.
And it seems to me, woke comedy isn't funny. It's not even comedy. There's something about the wokeness of it that removes the humor. I don't think I'm the only one who thinks that.
No, because comedy is about poking fun in many respects at ourselves. It's telling truths that aren't always so apparent to ourselves. It's smuggling the truths through a laugh. And Christopher Hitchens, who passed away in 2011, a famous author and journalist, had this saying that the most tiresome form of public debate is when ideological opponents assume that their worst possible motive is their only possible motive. And yeah. I feel like when you have audiences who are woke or whatever you want to call it, it's like they're always looking for you to trip up, and they're always looking to assume that the worst possible motive behind your joke is the only possible motive behind your joke. And that's no way to do comedy. That's no way to do comedy. Comedy, a good comedy audience is the one that allows for grace and kind of the wide expanse of universe where you can screw up, and that we're all there in service of the laugh. You know, we're not there in service of this broader cause to knock someone down or belittle them. Although that's happened sometimes, it's usually done in service of the laugh, and then you can joke about it at the end. And so you want to build that sort of goodwill with your audience. But if your audience isn't interested in goodwill, they're only interested in the thing that they can tweet about afterwards, then comedy isn't going to be funny. And you probably shouldn't attend a comedy show if you're that sort of person.
I want to get your comment about what the Australian eSafety Commissioner, the move that she pulled, ultimately unsuccessful, after the attack on the bishop, who's a well-watched bishop. He does live streams from his church every week, and he's been doing it for years, and he's quite a character. And someone had a go at him with a knife, and it was scary, but he survived. And then the Australian eSafety Commissioner came and wanted to pull that clip off social media, not only in Australia but around the world. The bishop said, hey, I'm okay with it. You know, leave it on. And it kind of became farcical. Now, you had some interest in that. This, you can understand someone trying to do it in their own country, but trying to delete it for the world is next level, isn't it?
It's totally next level. And fire doesn't usually work abroad. Our mission is focused on the United States of America. But we became particularly concerned about this when, of course, as you say, the safety commissioner said it's not enough for UX to just geo-block it within Australia. Australians can travel abroad, or they can use virtual private networks or VPNs to access this material. So you need to take it down globally. Now, this isn't something we've really ever seen before, a global takedown order. And if the justification for that won the day, just think about how authoritarian governments across the world would seize on that. China, Russia, North Korea, you know, you pick your authoritarian government. They would love to be able to issue global takedown orders. And so we at FIRE and our colleagues over at the Electronic Frontier Foundation did something that I don't think they do. I know we don't do all that often, which is intervene in a lawsuit abroad. And it managed to capture international headlines. And I suspect because of those international headlines, they ultimately backed down. I don't know, because I'm not in Australia, but it was interesting how quickly they collapsed once the world's spotlight was shown on them. But I don't think it'll be the last time we see a global takedown order, because you're seeing in these efforts by different countries to establish what they're calling digital sovereignty. And this was some of the justifications that were used in Brazil, for example, to force X to take down some right-leaning political figures and activists off of that platform, which ultimately led to, you know, a justice over there banning X in the country, and X eventually capitulated. But the argument was that we have our digital sovereignty and we should be able to police speech and these communications platforms however we see fit. That's the argument that China makes with its great firewall too, right?
Yeah.
And so I've always, and call me naive, I'm a big believer in the free and open internet. The cause that was in the 1990s and the early 2000s, this open access to the world's information, but it seems to be on ropes, and it doesn't seem to be a majority position now internationally. And that has me with cause for concern.
X is an interesting development, isn't it? Because before Elon Musk came along, Twitter was at the forefront of, well, censorship and narrative manipulation, influenced by the authorities, let's say. There's obvious connections there. Elon Musk has come along, and now it's the fly in the ointment, it seems, but it's the only fly in the ointment. Everything kind of rests on one platform for free speech, so-called. Yes. And that's a thin line, right? That's a thin line.
It is. It is. Now, there are other social media platforms that are positioning themselves in the market as free speech platforms. Rumble is one of them as a competitor to YouTube, but none of them are as big as Twitter, now X, is. And if you go back into the history of Twitter, actually, it positioned itself as the town square. And there was a saying among the founders that they were the free speech wing of the free speech party. But then the institution got captured and it became the censorship wing of the censorship party. And Elon Musk comes in, and actually a lot of the problems that we had with cancel culture were a result of Twitter. And I had mentioned earlier in our conversation that the cancel culture fever dream seemed to have broken in 2022, just kind of so happened to coincide with Elon Musk's takeover of X. I don't know if that was the leading cause, but it certainly was a cause, because cancel culture was always motivated and precipitated on X. Now, X is freer for expression, but not completely free, because Elon has his idiosyncrasies. Like, for example, if you share a Substack post, which is a competitor of his, you're host gets throttled. Journalists who have been critical of him have had their profiles taken down or throttled. So he's not entirely consistent, but net-net, I think it's better than it was. And I think cancel culture has waned as a result of a new sheriff in town over there at X.
Yeah, well put. You said that the fever had broken just before. And I'm just looking at a couple of survey results here. From your survey, 2024, so current, 63% of students support shoutdowns. Shoutdowns are like, you know, trying to stop people speaking at events, I take it. 27% said that violence to stop campus speech is acceptable. And those figures are up, not by much, but they're up kind of year on year. If the fever's broken, how long does it take for the patient to be able to get up out of bed and walk around and feel okay?
Well, you know, when I'm talking about cancel culture, I'm talking primarily about an effort that when you disagree with the speaker, you almost go and try and tattle on them to their parents, whether, you know, most often it's their employer, right? And during the cancel culture reign, that tattling worked, right? And what I'm saying now is that people are less inclined to organize these mobs to go tattle on people for things they said. Mm-hmm. And the institutions, I think, are less likely to capitulate.
Right.
Now, that isn't to say that you don't get demands for censorship to shut people up. You can demand for someone to be shut up without also demanding that they lose their job. My colleague Greg Lukianoff talks about cancel culture as a way to win an argument without actually winning an argument.
Yeah.
It's to go over the top of them and get their boss or their mom or whatever to kind of come in and censor them.
You've been a very naughty boy.
Yes. Well, that's what it feels like, right?
Yeah.
That's what it feels like. But there are other ways to censor people, and there are other ways to try and shut people up that might not fall neatly within the cancel culture definition and signal a broader concern about the culture of free speech. And you cited that statistic, which is very worrying to me, whether it's barricading an audience from preventing them to access an auditorium to hear a speech, or using violence to shout down a speaker or to shout down a speaker. All those numbers are up, and they've been going up. And this suggests just a fundamentally illiberal attitude about freedom of expression. And the First Amendment to the United States Constitution is as strong as it's ever been in American history. But you do have to worry that when these young people become the judges, when they do become the attorneys, when they take over the institutions that are entrusted with preserving America's culture for free speech, what's going to happen to that culture? What's going to happen? As Judge Learned Hand said in a speech in Central Park here in New York City in 1944, the spirit of liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, there's no law, there's no constitution, there's no piece of paper that can so much as save it. And I believe the First Amendment is something that's beautiful. It's the longest and sustained meditation on how to have free speech in a free society in a way that I think works. But at the same time, it's just words on a page. As I mentioned, the first 140 years of American history, it didn't do anything. Russia, China, North Korea, all of them have constitutions that promise freedom of speech, but they don't mean anything, right? So you need to have this spirit of liberty, and how you inculcate it is the challenge of the century. And it's one that we're trying to fight for every day here at FIRE, with varying degrees of success, unfortunately.
Okay, just coming up against time. Just sort of mapping ahead. How do you see this sort of playing out? Is this if we look at history, a kind of a waveform that you can see will work through and we will get to the other side, and then there'll be this sustained period of freedom of speech being venerated and promoted, and then it's swinging back round again like it has been recently? How do you see it going? Is there ever an ultimate victory here?
It's hard to say. My colleague Jakob Mushangama wrote this book, Free Speech, The History of Free Speech from Socrates to Social Media. And when you read it, you do see that censorship comes in waves. And it tends to come around times of discord and tumult, right? That when things are disorderly, people look to create order. And they often look to create order by shutting up the people they think are causing the disorder. And so that's why during World War I, you had a big wave of censorship here in the United States. That's why during the Cold War, you had a big wave of censorship here in the United States. That's why during the rise of the internet, you saw a big wave of censorship. And I do think here across the globe, as we're adjusting to our increasingly globalized economies and the rise of social media and artificial intelligence, people are uneasy and they're looking for safety. And they think that they can find that safety by appealing to government to just shut up the people who are making things disorderly or compromising that safety. It is weird and somewhat Orwellian that the Australian censor in chief of the internet is called the e-safety commissioner.
Safety, right? safety.
But that's what people want, right? And so it's you're fighting this propaganda war here on college campuses in the United States when they want to ban essentially a speaker that is controversial and not allow him to come to campus. They levy these excessive security fees on student groups who want to bring them. And student groups don't have any money. They can't afford these security fees. But who's going to argue against security, right? We all like security.
Safety.
Safety. So what we do as advocates for free expression is try and rebrand them. You know, those aren't security fees.
Right.
Those are speech taxes.
Yeah.
People might like security, but they hate taxes. So, we got to win the war of words too, to save our ability to use words, so to speak. So I have to be an optimist. Otherwise I wouldn't be in this game. Right. But I don't have, I'm not under any false pretense that the war for free expression can ever be won. I think it's something that needs to be fought for in every generation. And it's why my colleague Greg Lukianoff calls his Substack the eternally radical idea, which is another way to describe free speech. It's always going to be eternally radical. And you need to fight for it anew with every generation.
Nick Perino, Executive Vice President of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, FIRE, at thefire.org. It's been really interesting chatting with you. Nico, thanks for coming on. And folks can go to your website. You're on X. Also, there are the promos or the trailers for the movies, and I can give out the titles of those as we sort of move on in the program this morning. Thank you for coming on all the way from Washington, D.C. A lot to think about there. And you're so clear-minded about it, which is because there's a lot of lack of clarity around. To hear someone so clear-minded on this is great. So thanks for coming on our program.
It's been a lot of fun, Paul. Happy to come on anytime.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.